you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Colin Liddell back on the show. He returns to discuss some current events, recent events, the missile attack, the Tomahawk missile attack on a Syrian airfield ordered by President Trump. He also has penned a couple articles. One is one that's a few years old, but I think it's relevant. It's the gas cloud of Western intervention, how, gas warfare or chemical warfare is used as a pretext for Western intervention, and how it was banned after the First World War, despite the fact that a bunch of other horrible weapon platforms were invented. For some reason, that was singled out, and you cover that. And you also talk about one article about how Syria can win the war against America. Getting into the politics and the geopolitics behind this missile attack, this Tomahawk missile attack that was ordered. Colin, how you doing tonight?
Fine, yeah. Thanks for having me on your show again, Tim.
Well, thanks for returning. These articles that you wrote, one was particularly interesting, just the history of it. Do you want to get into the current events first, or a little background history about poison gas attacks?
It's sort of very noticeable how poison gas is being used has a kind of very convenient red line. And, people go on about poison gas being dangerous because it kills people. But actually, in a way, it's more dangerous because of the ease with which it enables certain countries to start and to justify war. And I mean, once you go to war, there's all sorts of terrible weapons that are unleashed. And I mean, we've been seeing this this wonderful new bomb, the Moab bomb, the mother of all bombs, or the I think it's the what's the official acronym for? I think that it means something else as well. But anyway, there's this enormous new bomb that apparently devastates everything within 1 mile, and that's supposed to be less terrible than a whiff of gas. So what we're dealing with here is gas as a means of certain actors in the geopolitical realm inserting red lines into situations to suit their convenience. You could also say the same things about images of dead children. So another thing that we might want to think about is banning images of dead children from the media, because that never seems to end very well.
Yeah, that's always seems to be exploited, because, and it's always they're very selective on the children they pick. We don't, you know, we don't see too many Palestinian dead children.
Yes, or Yemeni dead children, or
And I mean, obviously, that brings up to mind the image of the boy that allegedly drowned on the beach during the last year, during the that when the migration crisis was getting a lot of press. And
that reminds me about the recent truck attack in Sweden, where that young girl was basically, you know, smeared across the sidewalk like hamburger meat. And that's another image you're not seeing very much off on the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm. Because some victims matter more than others, because it serves a political interest. We have the situation, of course, in Syria, where it is alleged that the Assad regime first ordered a chemical attack. And now there's some question of the origin of the attack, or what it exactly was. Some people now saying that might have been a weapon or a depot that had been hit by the Assad regime that was controlled by the rebels, which again begs the question. Like,
well, there's lots of possibilities, isn't there? I mean, and of course we don't actually know. I mean, it's even possible that some of these neocon voices are actually. Right. I mean, I doubt it, but it's not without the realms of possibility. I think the situation with Syria was that, like a lot of countries, Syria developed chemical weapons. There's various reasons to explain or justify that. I mean, basically, if your rival states have those weapons, then you're almost kind of forced to have them as well. And I'm pretty sure that a lot of the other countries in the region have chemical weapons, or in the case of Israel, have even worse weapons, i.e. nuclear weapons. And then when the Syrian civil war developed into this very, very tangled web of chaos, the fact that Syria had these chemical weapons was, of course, a problem, because some of them were falling into the hands of the rebels, and some of them were in the hands of government forces. But at the same time, government forces were becoming increasingly decentralized, and there was a kind of general situation of chaos. So you could have, you know, like local commanders who run out of one form of ammunition, resorting to chemical weapons in a kind of as a kind of stopgap solution. And so when there was a large chemical incident in 2013, there was a lot of pressure put on Syria to kind of get rid of its stockpiles of chemical weapons. And I actually think they probably did do that, and they probably got rid of most of their weapons. But it's always possible that in a chaotic situation, not all the weapons are fully accounted for, either on the rebel side or the government side. So it is possible that a local commander used some kind of chemical device for that attack on that village. But that's just one of many possibilities. Of course, the other possibility that's been much talked about is the idea that the Russians seem to favor, which is this was a conventional bombing attack on a rebel base or storage facility, and it just happened to hit their chemical weapon stash. There are, of course, other theories, like it's an obvious false flag which has been perpetrated by, you know, kind of deep state actors or whatever. So, take your pick, as they say.
Yeah, well, it is a civil war going on, and so there's much confusion. Of course, that confusion is contrived because it's this attempt of regime change by the United States and its Gulf state allies and Israel for various reasons. So, yeah, the mayhem that's created is sort of a planned chaos because they want to destabilize the region. It's part of the Iran-Iran plan, the larger geopolitical plans that, you know, goes at least as far back as the George W. Bush administration.
Yeah.
So Trump entered the White House, and he sort of as he went to the White House, all these intrigues are swirling about. So so just because one single election isn't going to change the larger geopolitical agenda that's been afoot here for at least a decade, you know.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how much it is part of that kind of agenda, because I think how many days is it now since Trump launched his cruise missile attack?
A week now. Yeah,
so roughly about a week, isn't it? And there hasn't been much of a follow-up that you would expect to see if that was just like the first salvo.
Yeah.
So I'm more inclined at the moment. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. As we speak, even stuff could be happening. But I'm more inclined to see this as part of his East Asian policy at the moment. And that kind of centers on this this North Korean situation. And I think Trump actually, you've got to. I mean, Trump said things in the past about getting involved in Syria with boots on the ground would be stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, even though he's not always the most consistent person, I think he generally believes that it's not a good thing to put lots of U.S. ground forces in there, and that would really be America's Achilles heel. I mean, as I mentioned in my other article. Mm-hmm. How Syria can defeat or how Syria can win its war against America. And so I think the way it looks to me now, 1 week after the initial strike and with no follow-up, is that it's playing into his policy vis-a-vis North Korea. And, very famously, this attack took place while he was having dinner with the Chinese president.
Yeah.
And so he's sort of making the point like, I'm not some guy like Obama who, hums and haws and waits for other people to sign up before I lead. I just go out there and I do things. And so that, therefore I'm unpredictable. I might just do this. So therefore my, what I'm thinking or what I'm intending has consequences. And so he's making a power move by doing that. And I think the intended object is the Chinese, of course. He wants the Chinese to kind of do his dirty work with regard to North Korea. He wants them to put the pressure on and to kind of push them into a position where they kind of denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. Whether that would work or not is, of course, the big question. But, I mean, there's other things that have happened in recent days which also play into that. The other thing that that sort of struck me was this, why did they unleash this new monster bomb? Just the other day, I think this is the first time they actually dropped this bomb, and it was in the middle of nowhere, basically in part of Afghanistan where there is some kind of ISIS affiliate, and I'm pretty sure it didn't really do too much damage to the ISIS people in the area, but it probably made a big noise and it probably caused a lot of damage to the rock strata in that area. but the point of that, again, is to demonstrate, if North Korea isn't going to play ball, we've got certain weapons that we can actually use to really mess up their nuclear installations. The purpose of that weapon, I guess, would be some kind of like bunker busting kind of effect. It creates a kind of it's big enough so that it kind of creates a small earthquake, and so anything that the North Koreans are developing, they'll be developing that deep underground in quite strong bunkers. And so I think he's trying to show, look, we've actually got something that could probably break through your air defenses, and so that fits into the the sort of the pattern that he, Trump's actions are actually mainly aimed at East Asia, and you know, that's kind of interesting and surprising focus in itself, because in many ways, you know, North Korea could be a very tough nut to crack. I don't think they would really want to, you know, give up their nuclear weapons. Now, the other point, the other thing about, you know, the other thing about attacking North Korea in this way, even though it has nuclear weapons, that's also very, very interesting, because there is a kind of consensus around the world that, and this is something that basically became very, very solidified during the Obama presidency, that if you have nuclear weapons, the USA will leave you alone. And that's a very, very kind of dangerous idea, you know, for these countries to have, because if people start believing that, and then, of course, that gives them an enormous impetus to develop nuclear weapons. And right now, there is a big question mark over whether Iran is developing nuclear weapons or not. And so if you have somebody like Trump going up against North Korea and saying, like, you know, you have to disarm your nuclear weapons, and we don't care that you have nuclear weapons, we'll still take you on. That sends a very strong message to a country like Iran as well. So the Iranians might think, even if we get nuclear weapons, the Americans aren't going to necessarily leave us alone.
Mm. Well, the problem with that is this geopolitical multidimensional chess is that it's just precisely this type of intervention which makes such a mess of things. Trump did a campaign. He wouldn't be the first presidential candidate to run as, quote, the peace candidate, and then forget his base. I'm going down the list, you know, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Eisenhower roughly kept it because he got us out of Korea, but of course Lyndon Johnson was the peace candidate, right? It's like the joke was, they told me if I voted for Barry Goldwater, we'd be at war the next year. I voted for Barry Goldwater, and we were at war the next year. The old joke back in 1964, 65. You know, and George W. Bush was a peace candidate. He echoed, you know, at least he said similar things that Trump said about America being a normal nation and not intervening. Of course, 9/11 changed everything, and it's just, that's an expensive way to send a message to China. Of course, then it's probably good for the stock of Lockheed Martin, whoever manufactured the Tomahawk missiles. He fired 60 of them or something, and I think at $1.5 million apiece, what's that, like $90 million right there? You know, to mess up an airfield?
An empty airfield, yes, yeah. Which was in operation a couple of days later.
You know, so this profligate bankrupt empire just lobbing missiles there. I imagine he killed somebody. Someone was there.
Apparently a lot of them were actually shot down, I'm hearing.
Which raises another question. Is it because the Russian air defenses that they gave the Syrians are that good, or the missiles they're making are that crappy?
a bit of both, probably.
Yeah. So it's a bit, I mean, the trouble, because he did said non-intervention, and to me, this type of, like I said, much of the problem in the world, around the world, obviously all the world's problems can't be attributed to Western intervention, particularly American interventionism, but much of it is, because simply they lack the integrity and the wisdom to manage the world properly, and nor, assuming they had the best of intentions. I mean, again, when you're talking about what's been going on in the Middle East for the past several decades, you're talking about, I think, transnational interests, banking interests, you know, Anglo-American banking interests that want to dominate the world, sort of the Kissinger model, you know, the Rockefeller idea of managing the world, you know, through chaos and wars and destabilization, the IMF system of doing things.
Yeah, but I think causing chaos in Northeast Asia I mean, sort of taking that sort of that approach, which we've seen at play in the Middle East to a large degree,
mm-hmm.
and sort of taking that template and applying it to Northeast Asia, which might be on the cards now. Who knows? That could be very, very interesting, and very certainly interesting for me as I live in Japan.
Yes. Now, what's Japan? I mean, Japan's looking at America. America's looking at, you know, her foreign policy is more deranged every day, and I mean, Japan.
Well, we see this as a form of derangement, but you've got to always look for the method in the madness. I think, you know, even if it does turn out to be ultimately madness, before you go there, you've got to try to see if there is actually something going on, and you know, there well could be. I mean, like you know, this the North Korean problem, if we refer to it as that, it does affect it affects Japan, obviously, and in a way it also affects China, because, you know, North Korea is of course usually aligned with China more or less, but that if they have their own, you know, independent nuclear capability, then you know, they don't actually need to do that quite as much. And you know, if North Korea and China fall out for whatever reason, which is quite possible, because, you know, China is, relative to North Korea, kind of liberalizing and becoming more like a, you know, inverted commas, normal nation, you know, part of the global system, in other words. So that could be a problem for China, you know, because, you know, North Korea could end up, you know, using those weapons on any one of its neighbors. Mm-hmm. So it sort of benefits China if North Korea doesn't have those nuclear weapons. So I think they might be in a very ambivalent position about that, and they might actually be thinking, wait a minute, if Trump can, you know, go in there and blow the shit out of North Korea's nuclear weapons, then we can pretend to be all angry about that and score a few points over the United States. But at the end of the day, we get a bit of a benefit because we have a former nuclear power on our borders that is no longer a nuclear power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. I mean, at a certain level, that is true. But I'm looking at the longer range picture, both in history than forward, is that the whole situation on the Korean Peninsula is because of Western, particularly American intervention in Asia. This is a blowback from the Second World War, which I think was at least the Pacific War between Japan and the United States was provoked by the United States, and Japan itself as a militarist power was awakened, you know, by Commodore Perry and showing up and forcing them to modernize, and, you know, Japan was the cat's paw of U.S. and British imperialism in Asia for a better part of 3-4 decades. Then when they got too independent, they had, you know, that's when the United States turned on Japan, and, you know, sort of their backdoor to war to get into the war in Europe with when Roosevelt and his intrigues, you know, arranged for Pearl Harbor. But you know, there's the whole thing with Vietnam and Korea. That's both of those wars. One thing, 1950, that's Dean Acheson said Korea saved us. You know, it wasn't. It was a provoked crisis. The whole thing was kind of necessary for the whole UN agenda and the American empire. So the American national security state was sort of a fledgling bird at that point before it could spread its wings. And the crisis in Europe and crisis in Asia solidified the Cold War, because until then, the Republican Congress was very skittish about signing on to Truman's agenda, and Korea came along. That's what Dean Acheson in his memoir says. Korea came along and saved us. And of course, this was a few months after he was in the winter of 1950 or 50, winter of 50. He says, you know, Korea's well outside our defense perimeter. You know, the same way that April Glaspie told Saddam Hussein that we have no opinion on your dispute with Kuwait in 1990. Yeah. You know, sort of like, we don't care. And also, then, of course, the invasion occurs. Of course, there's some dispute about that as well. All of a sudden, it's this emergency that has to be policed by the UN. And this sort of creates this precedent where the president can unilaterally, just like Trump just did with Syria, unilaterally order, you know, a massive invasion and send an expeditionary force under the guise of the UN, of course. And, yeah, yeah. You know, so now that was a horrible precedent from the standpoint of, I think, the Constitution here in the United States, because at least prior to that, at least Roosevelt, although he, I think, arranged for Pearl Harbor, at least he still had to ask Congress for a declaration of war. You know, that's the last time we declared war, I think, was 1942.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's also part of it, isn't it? Because, you know, one of the points that Trump's making, whether explicitly or implicitly, is that you know, when you have to go through all the correct procedures, and you have to go through Congress, and you have to get other people to sign on board, then it basically makes the executive much weaker, much more predictable. So other countries can therefore gain an advantage from that, because mm-hmm. they're not constrained in the same way. And so the executive has to have that kind of instantaneous power to react or to do something proactive. And of course, that rides roughshod over the basic principles on which America was founded. But of course, that was a completely different era where, you know, war was allowed to, you know, gently mature before it was kind of uncorked.
Yeah, that's true to a certain point, I think. But you know, when you look at all the U.S. wars, I strain when I study U.S. history to find a generally defensive war. Let's go way back. I mean, it's the War of 1812. I mean, yeah, the pretext for that was the impressment issue. What the British Navy was doing. Of course, that was also during the Napoleonic Wars. But really, if you look into that war deeper into it, what really drove that war was, territorial ambitions that certain factions in the U.S. government had towards Canada. And some people even have suggested that war ultimately was fomented by the Rothschilds and banking interests in London because of the failure of the Congress to renew the Bank of the U.S.'s charter in 1811. Mexican War, that was a war of conquest, more or less, just to seize Mexican territory. That really wasn't a defensive war, even if you justify the expansion of the U.S., it certainly wasn't defensive. You know, you have Lincoln's War, the so-called Civil War, that technically wasn't a war, but even that was provoked by Lincoln. The Spanish-American War, you know, sinking of the Maine, yeah, right. That was, you know, what drove that war again was the territorial or the colonies in the Caribbean and also in the Pacific. They were coveted by U.S. financial interests, particularly the banking interests. And also the desire to expand into Asia, which of course would lead us into the Second World War. But then you have Wilson's War, Wilson's taking us to war against Germany in World War I. It was all based on lies, and that wasn't really to make the world safe for democracy or really defend genuine U.S. interests. In the final analysis, Woodrow Wilson was a greater threat to U.S. liberty than the Kaiser, considering, you know, the domestic policies that he instituted to prosecute that war. It was more to bail out Wall Street and the British Empire. Of course, that led to the Second World War, and so much for U.S. intervention making the world safe, right? Because it just created the conditions for the Second World War, and then, of course, in prosecuting that war, all types of war atrocity stories, just like in World War I, had to be floated. But they were much, you know, of course, these war atrocity stories were much worse. I think they were floated after the war for the purposes of geopolitical reasons, the whole Holocaust narrative thing. And you know, that's become so established that even to question it now is to threaten imprisonment in some countries. So, you know, it's hard to find a genuine justification for sort of an imperial presidency, you know, necessity for an imperial presidency, not having to be hamstrung by Congress or the usual rules of constitutional government.
Yeah, well, it seems like America is has to work extra hard to be involved in all these wars because, you know,
yeah.
as a country, it is naturally isolationist, i.e. has these two large oceans which basically exist to keep it out of trouble with other parts of the world. And
yeah.
they're not really working quite so well at the moment. But yeah, America could get on very well on its own, and it wouldn't really need to be bothered with all these complex geopolitical affairs. I mean, you can't say the same with regard to countries like Russia or China, because they are, because they're land powers and
continental powers. Yeah,
They have to really be. I mean, Russia, for example, has to in a way be involved in the Middle East, you know, because it is overwhelmingly dependent upon its oil economy. Mm-hmm. And so that means it's very, very vulnerable to, you know, the manipulation of prices on that particular commodity. Mm-hmm. And so from the Russian point of view, they want to basically kind of line up their interests with the other oil producers. And the only way they can do that is if they have some kind of agreement or some kind of alliance with those kind of countries. And I think that's what the Russians are. That's why the Russians are involved in the Middle East. That's their whole kind of motivation for being there. I mean, they've got the Iranians on board, and the Iraqis are kind of like more or less on board. But they can still be countered by the other Gulf states. And so by, you know, having their guy in Syria, that gives them a bit more leverage in the Sunni Arab world.
Yeah,
and you know, they're also, I think the Russians are also quite close to General Sisi in Egypt. So there's an obvious policy that the Russians are following, which is to kind of you know, be seen as the good guy in the Middle East. And I think they are trying to kind of like say, you know, we're the middleman between the Shiites and the Sunnis, and we want everybody to, you know, to basically win. And you know, we're all connected to the oil industry, and if we line up our interests and we create a kind of power of monopoly or cartel, then you know we're all going to do well out of it. And so don't let the Americans and the Israelis come in and divide us up. That's the basic line that they're trying to sell. Mm-hmm. And of course the West is not entirely too happy about that for various reasons. It could really blow away the whole basis of the petrodollar if the Russians you know, became too ascendant in that particular area of the world. So I think you know, there are those kinds of vested interests that the Russians have. Now the Americans, you could say the Americans have certain economic vested interests, but they're not really that as vital to America as those interests are to Russia, I think.
Yeah. No, I think what it is, well, I mean, the thing is that sort of level or depth of analysis isn't what's retailed to the public regarding it. It's always a moralistic fairy tale. Assad has to go. Yeah. He's an evil dictator. So the public and the political process addresses this cartoonish moralistic fairy tale, you know, where evil dictators have to go. Saddam Hussein's Hitler, you know, Gaddafi's the madman of North Africa. These things, and there's no analysis of this petrodollar, you know, the idea of a China, Russia, Europe condominium challenging, you know, the Atlanticist powers and these stuff. If you put it in those terms, then at least we're getting down to brass tacks. Now we're dealing with power politics, sort of this mercantilist conflict here, instead of this, you know, let's dispense with the moralism at least. Let's talk like adults about this stuff. Because if it's to defend the petrodollar, what's the basis of the petrodollar? It's the Pentagon and you know, it's the missiles and the submarines. Because there's, you know, because ever since the dollar was cut loose from gold and the American economy was subsequently deindustrialized, there's very little productivity to back the U.S. dollar, which is still dominant in trade because of the Pentagon.
Yeah, that's no. why I actually think that you know, Putin and the Iranians and Hezbollah and, you know, all those kind of people are aligned. They actually should be pushing for a gradual escalation, and they should be pushing to kind of draw America in more and more. You know, because it is a, you know, the more America gets sucked in, I think the more America will become weaker and will actually lose. Now, if you allow America to stay offshore and to bomb what the fuck they like,
yeah,
that keeps America in this kind of like this position of kind of hegemonic dominance. The paper tiger remains intact. And so if you can just like bring that paper tiger into the kind of the mucky world of ground warfare in the Middle East more and more, then, you know, we saw what happened last time, you know, when that happened in Iraq. America became this incredibly war-weary nation, and it also became completely detested by Europe, which is the other, you know, main pillar of this kind of global dominance that that they project through NATO. And things got so bad that they had to bring in this guy Obama to kind of like you know, paper over the cracks.
Yeah, and well, this is another thing. Again, you mentioned Europe, because I think much of the destabilization we're seeing in the in countries like Libya and Syria is an indirect attack on Europe and the euro to prop up the dollar, because all the yeah. you know, because the migration crisis, this destabilized the euro. You also have the exposure, you know, the Greek debt, which was set up by Goldman Sachs, and of course, and the, in this, and all the European banks that had, you know, bought the Greek debt because of Goldman Sachs had cooked the books so they could get into the Maastricht Treaty. So it's complete fraud. It's set up. But a lot of this is just a bluff, because, you know, it's the whole banking system is a confidence racket. There's no fundamentals behind it. It's all psychological, and so you can create crises here and there, which is probably what they look for. It's why they like the fractional reserve banking system, because they can foment a crisis at a key point, and, you know, and create a crisis, and they can you know, pump and dump, and then return come back in and buy everything for a song. But at the same time, if you look at, you know, at key points, whenever there's a problem in Europe, it's when the dollar's being challenged. You know, so you get a migration crisis. You get this whole thing with you know, largely the geopolitics challenging Russia. You know, in Russia's near abroad, like we're talking Ukraine here, and you're Victoria Nuland, who's handpicking the Ukrainian, you know, prime minister or president or whatever. We have these Soros-backed NGOs that are now, they've been caught, you know, taxing in refugees into Europe, you know, these, you know, to destabilize Europe. At the same time,
it does destabilize Europe, because it creates, you know, this kind of groundswell for people like Marine Le Pen, who actually want to break up the EU. And so,
yeah,
you know, personally, I think it's actually a necessary thing, because I think, There is a case for some kind of European Union, but not in its present horribly toxic form.
How do you get Germany and Greece to be in the same, have the same currency? That's absurd. Two completely different cultures. One's big on savings, you know, wary of fearful of inflation for historical reasons. You know, highly productive.
For honesty in all things, I think they should just rename it the Fourth Reich. You know, in its present form, it's just a device for keeping this latest incarnation of the Deutschmark from over-appreciating.
Yeah. You know, but you know, that's how they were sold on it. Where was it? I guess I think it was Helmut Kohl. Was it Helmut Kohl was told this would allow for, you know, German dominance of the continent, and he signed on to it. But I think there's another a deeper level to this again, because you know, we're talking about, you know, the central bankers of the world and the few people that control these things and the debt. Because obviously, someone like Merkel, who seems to be an agent, you know, of the Anglican power, of the Anglo-American Zio powers, because she seems to be so determined to bring in all these refugees and destroy Germany as what it remains of a sort of an ethno-state. She wants to, and this goes back to a larger plan that, you know, like that Wesley Clark has talked about, that Sutherland from, you know, has Peter Sutherland has talked about, destroying the ethnic foundation for the European states, to break up of the European states. And some have speculated this whole thing, the whole crisis, this immigration crisis, is an attempt to create a European identity, because as a part of the dialectic, because the reaction to it, because now we must defend European civilization, you know. And
it's really hard to see which way it's, I mean, you know, whichever theory you have, there is some evidence to support it. I mean, there is a a growing feeling of European nationalism, but at the same time, there's not nearly enough yet. And so, you know, you could either say that Europe will wake up and it will reassert itself, or it will wake up too late and it'll be half Muslim by then, and who knows what will happen, civil war, or it'll just become like that Holbeck novel, Submission.
Well, a lot of it's because they've been demoralized for so long. They've been under psychological warfare for decades since, well, I'd say go back to World War One, but particularly since World War Two, with the pessimism, the nihilism, you know, so existentialism, like in France, which I guess caught on after World War One because of the horrible losses that they took, but particularly after World War Two, you know, with the declining birth rates, and so now you have this demographic problem.
I mean, the decline in birth rates, that was just basically that sprang out of certain technological and social innovations, which had not been anticipated, and because of that, you actually need to have something that is consciously countering that, and so people have to become much more racially and much more racially aware, much more aware of demographics and birth rates and the role of women, and all that has to be put into a much more conscious and political. That has to be put much more on the kind of conscious political side, whereas before, women having enough babies was just taken for granted.
Yeah, that's right. This is the culture war.
Mm.
Defending that, you have to defend the natural and obvious.
These political developments, they're there to kind of offset these deficiencies that arise from the social system, or from the negative effects of new technologies, or for economic problems. And so, yeah, I think all these things are not really natural to us yet. People are a lot less nationalistic. They're a lot less tribal than they need to be, because a lot of their kind of impulses to survive as a group just grew out of their natural situation, and that natural situation has now changed, and so because of that, they're effectively dying, and so they've got to develop a new political way of thinking, a new ideology that counters all these forces.
But it's hard to do that without being accused of being a Nazi, though.
Right? Yeah, well, that's just one of the things that we have to overcome.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously the ethnic foundation for community is one of the, I think, the most solid foundation for community, ethno-religious, right? Ethno-religious. If we want to support community, people will say, you hear the word community a lot. It doesn't mean anything anymore. Because
communities used to just be organic. They just used to happen naturally.
Yeah.
People didn't have social media to avoid their neighbors through, or cable TV to sort of isolate themselves in their own little bubble, and so all these things used to be organic. Women having enough children, it just naturally organically happened. Communities forming naturally organically happened. People organizing against invaders, or however they came, that was just a natural thing. But we've created a kind of society and environment where all these things are nurtured in various ways, and often I don't think it's some great conspiracy like a lot of people are inclined to believe. I mean, I actually do endorse conspiracy thinking, because I think that's a kind of emotional way that people can get to the point where they kind of assert the right kind of political ideas that they need to survive. Even though it's based on paranoia, that kind of paranoia can be very, very healthy.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. We shouldn't oversimplify these things. Not everything is a result of or a product of a conspiracy. It's not as if David Rockefeller or George Soros or personally planning the programming on MTV to get to our kids, corrupt our kids. It's not that simple. But society has its own momentum. Culture has its own momentum and timing, I guess. But nevertheless, there are prime movers. And the evidence does suggest of certain high-level malfeasance, well-organized high-level malfeasance, looking to fundamentally change or degrade the culture, if you will, through mass programming, entertainment, education, and such. That goes way back even to the Rockefellers, or the General Education Board, and Frederick T. Gates looking to, you know, keep society dumbed down so they have workers, not thinkers. But more recently, in 1969, I mean, Planned Parenthood was commissioned by the federal government. They had a meeting, I think it was just outside Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And according to some of the notes or minutes that were taken, what was discussed there wasn't recorded. But according to the notes, what was discussed there was a concerted effort by Planned Parenthood and other agencies and, I guess, organizations to promote family breakup through promoting divorce. And we got no-fault divorce, through the promotion of sexual liberation, perhaps, or sexual freedom, as they call it, and the promotion of homosexuality. I mean, how do you promote homosexuality? Well, you can do it by creating a toxic culture through the media and through making sure that, you know, if you create a situation where more families are broken up or family never formed, children are much more vulnerable to being abused and trauma, and this creates much higher rates of dysfunction, including sexual dysfunctions. And it appears that this was sort of scientifically planned out. You also have, I mean, with, now you have to ask yourself why were certain figures promoted? You know, why was Gloria Steinem made a celebrity? When, of course, she has, her pedigree goes right back to the CIA. Why does everyone know who Allen Ginsberg was? Why was Alfred Kinsey and his dubious and also criminal research promoted to promote a certain cultural agenda, legitimize to create the academic support for the sexual revolution that would be promoted in the ensuing decade through entertainment and music? And you have Time Life magazine that's promoting psychedelic drug use a decade before the Summer of Love, 1967. And more recently, of course, we had, if you look at the AIDS crisis or AIDS scare of the 1980s, that was used as a pretext to implement sex ed programs and to expose kids to graphic sex ed education programs. And that was written up in the, I think it was the National Research Council. I think it was the report. They said that the whole purpose of the sex ed programs wasn't there to protect kids' health. It was done on the cover of a public health measure. It was there to fundamentally change younger students' sexual values and mores and attitudes. And they used the public health measure was just a cover because they realized with the fear of AIDS, they could get away with these things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get away with because there'd be too much resistance on the part of parents. And so you do have that high level, again, there's evidence that this stuff is being orchestrated or planned out. Not everything is controlled, but the cultural mandarins are in a position to promote certain ideas, memes, and values through entertainment, through advertising, and directly into the school system, particularly through the public school system. So I don't think it's quite as spontaneous as it was laid out to be. I think it was much more controlled than most people care to believe.
It was a kind of trickle-down effect, though, because I think the upper classes had these things a lot earlier than the masses.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think the upper classes were sort of going through this process more or less in the late 19th century. And then by the time we get to the 1960s, it starts to trickle down to everybody else.
But here in the States, a good example is it's no coincidence that, during the Second World War and right after the Second World War, there was a concerted and planned effort, a program to break up the ethnic neighborhoods under the pretext of urban renewal and racial integration. And the whole purpose of racial integration was not racial integration. It was actually to create white flight and to create the diaspora into the suburbs. At the same time, the federal government was implementing things like the Federal Housing Administration, a 30-year mortgage, to get the ethnic whites into the suburbs, the idea was for them to lose their ethnic identity, particularly the Catholics who had high birth rates, and this was part of the WASP elite, who looked askance at the growing Catholic power in America. And of course, this was signified in the election of John F. Kennedy in 1960. Yeah. So they were very worried about that. At the same time, for the better part of 40 years, because of Catholic power in the United States, they were able to impose a production code in Hollywood. So the Jewish moguls in Hollywood were very happy to see the Catholic power weaken in the United States, because with that, they could now break the production code and then make the movies they wanted to make. And this was key in creating the social conditions, not only for the sexual revolution, but also for the development of a kind of a deracinated white middle class addicted to consumerism and ultimately to debt.
Yeah, it's often a case of which one is the cart and which one is the horse, yeah. Because a lot of these trends, also you could say that they just follow from the economic logic, where you're trying to stimulate the economy, and one way to do that is to develop the suburbs. Another way is to get women into the workforce to decrease the dependency ratio, things like that. All those things have a very strong economic effect as well, and therefore that kind of brings in all these kind of cultural forces. And so, which one is first? It's a chicken or egg situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's which one was first?
Two things go hand in hand.
Yeah,
it's not really sure. It's not really clear which one is the cause and which one is the effect.
But the idea of get back to kind of weaponized migration, the sort of psychological warfare that is involved in that. We saw that example here in the United States. Again, I mentioned the integration, the shipping of black sharecroppers north into the cities during the Second World War to create, because of the labor shortage created by the Second World War. Now, that was one aspect of it. Another aspect was the industry liked it because they brought in all this labor to smash the weaken the labor unions. Good example in Detroit, I think it was Detroit, where they shipped in all these black sharecroppers from the South to work in the factories and dumped them in the middle of a Polish neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Then were shocked that there was problems. Well, they expected the problems. They wanted the problems. And in the 1960s, it was exposed in the 1960s that the Health Education Welfare Department of Health Education Welfare had given $900,000 to this black gang called the Blackstone Rangers. And it was part of these community block grants and all that. Now, people write it off as government waste and incompetence, but the intention there was to create white flight, to terrorize the white ethnics and make them sell their houses fast and go into the suburbs. Why I'm saying this is very similar to the gangs like in the Ukraine that the NGOs pay for, or ISIS, which is backed by the Gulf states and operating out of NATO. They're kind of designed to go in and to create mayhem, to create the instability. And then you can profit off the instability.
They definitely don't want everybody just to kind of settle down and have nice, peaceful lives, because once you get a nice neighborhood, you've got your own house going, you've got your family going, then you just want to sit back and enjoy life, and you don't want to work too hard. And if you get enough people doing that on a large enough scale, think of the enormous downturn in the economy that actually creates, because people are less agitated, they're less worried, they're less driven by the need to relocate somewhere or get money to buy a new house in the suburbs.
Yeah.
And so it would destroy the entire global economy. So you need to keep people on their toes. That's one way to do it. You import blacks into a Polish neighborhood back in the 1960s or whenever that was.
Yeah, 40s, yeah.
Yeah, 40s, and you see the same thing in Europe. I mean, why? What is the? I mean, you could go into the geopolitics of the Middle East, but why bother? You've got to look at it in a more kind of macro empirical way. What does bringing all these young, mainly male, military age Muslim guys into Europe do, it makes everybody, puts everybody on edge.
Yeah.
You know, your safety zone no longer exists. Therefore, you think, oh, God, I've got to move, or I've got to get more money, or I've got to do this, or I've got to do that. You know what I mean? So you actually see it as a kind of weird and very, very perverted economic driver.
Well, it's sort of Naomi Klein, I don't agree with everything she says, but her general idea of the shock doctrine, I kind of agree with the idea that you, whether it's through wars or economic calamities, and the it's almost like the system is set up that they can trigger an economic calamity when they want it, or they can trigger a war when they want it. And that's what's the going way back. Are you familiar with the Rees Committee of the 50s and investigating the foundations? And here in the United States, they're investigating some of the tax-free foundations, and then it was suspected that they were supporting communism. But the thing was, communism was only one level. Communism was a controlled thing. It was a control is to create that fear, to manage a crisis, to create the Cold War, so you could have that conflict that would justify the immense defense budgets and the mounting debt that the system relies on. The system relies on debt. The money is based on debt. The whole thing is based on debt.
And debt is based on emotion.
Yeah, yeah. And it was Norman Dodd was the chief investigator of the Rees Committee. It was a congressional committee investigating this, and this was the some of the ideas or causes that the foundations were supporting. These tax free foundations were supporting communism or radical causes, and then it was done because they thought it might be communist, but there was something else going on here. And Norman Dodd sent a young lady, Catherine Casey, up to investigate the read through the minutes of the Carnegie Foundation. Never for peace. And now what happened was, for some reason or another, they let her see everything, okay? And maybe a fit of absent-mindedness or just sort of a revelation of the method, I don't know. But what she uncovered was that as far back as 1909, the Carnegie Foundation was talking about how do we fundamentally change the United States. It's too independent. It's too decentralized. How do we change it? And the best way to change it, we found, was to subject it to a series of crises, particularly wars. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, the 20th century, right? And so, in fact, what she found in these minutes, what she read in these minutes, it was such a shock to her, a blow to her, her worldview, that she had a nervous breakdown and could never live a normal life anymore, because she was, a lawyer, well-educated, she believed in the system, the American system, and she found out that some of the most powerful families and foundations were dedicated to a long-term plan to fundamentally change, collectivize the country by using a series of crises. And all the wars that she had read about and experienced and lived through wasn't what she thought it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you can't let the working class get too organized or cozy.
Yes.
You basically got to keep them fretting and moving from pillar to post and running around in circles so that the economy can thrive.
Yeah, and you get people like, if you get figures like Edward Bernays, he's just one man, but he kind of reflects this. He's the one devising governmental policy, advertising, and people like B.F. Skinner and behaviorism, and this shapes our schooling system,
mm-hmm.
and how we're educated and how we think of ourselves, and whole. I just interviewed Dr. Joseph Farrell talking about Common Core, and he was studying Common Core. He found out that going back, the electronic testing service, the whole system of standardized testing, they worked with the Human Ecology Fund, which links it to MK Ultra. So I mean, this is Harvard University, and the whole idea was to gather mass data on people so they can be classified and monitored. And that's his thesis. This is what Common Core is all about,
mm-hmm.
and not just dumbing everything down. That's a side issue. The big issue is it's that just through standardized testing, they can monitor everybody. So you know, at times, yeah, it's hard to think, believe that something, a plan like this could be so well thought out and, you know, detailed.
Well, I don't think it is. I think it's a number of processes which go in the direction dictated by the dynamic of economics, which is always to try to, you know, to increase in some way, to increase economic activity in various ways. And there are sort of countervailing forces that push against that. I mean, mm-hmm. people generally don't want to be running around 24/7 working themselves into an early grave. And so there's those natural human instincts to just take it easy and to do enough and no more. And that works against these kind of economic forces. And these economic forces, to get around that basic inertia of human nature, it sort of develops all these weird systems. And I think the process is not done entirely. I mean, some people are conscious of parts of it, or they're more conscious of other parts of it than other people are. But generally speaking, I think it's a largely unconscious or semi-conscious kind of process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that we don't actually understand how we're being manipulated by these economic forces and our own human psychology and our own failings as a society. We lack a kind of awareness of how the world works, and so we get pushed along in these directions that we're not really choosing ourselves. So we kind of lack agency. We lack a sense of will, a sense of consciousness, and even the brightest amongst us are in that kind of boat. Maybe even more than the normal people, because the normal people are just trying to develop their natural in economic inertia, and they're not being allowed to.
Now, I mean, but if people did have things like communities, parishes, churches that they belong to, and
well, those are forms of economic inertia, because they allow people to just live quite happily without going to the bloody shopping mall every day or whatever.
Yeah, well, this is the whole time turning people into consumers. But yeah. if people had a good example, we all have a longing to belong to something, and so when we're deprived of community, then the extended family is what we used to relate to. You're a member of a clan, and then you're deprived of a nuclear family because now the divorce rate's so high. Now you're just this atomized individual, which seems to be promoted.
That's right. Yeah, that's the family, the community, the your local parish. Those are all forms of economic inertia.
But
by breaking those down, people are forced to find substitutes through the market economy.
Yeah, like brand names. Apple computer,
they develop psychological problems. They have to go and see a shrink or whatever. You know what I mean? So, or they feel spiritually vacuous, so they have to develop some sort of drug habit or whatever.
Well, and that's an industry in of itself too, because the same people who run the pharmaceutical companies are the same people that run the agribusinesses and the education system. As far as the financial interest, good example. I was listening to. Oh, what's his name? Oh, yeah, man, forgive me. Wait, he was 25% of all college students are receiving psychiatric care right now. 25%.
College. You say college students? That's obviously.
Yeah.
Why do we have this enormous college inverted commas industry? I mean,
that's a whole other. Yes, that's a whole other.
I guess is yet another symptom of. Yeah. Finding something that could be, actually knowing about stuff, education, that's just, again, that is subject to the same processes of economic inertia that I've been talking about. I mean, if you just sit with a good book, basically you don't need to go to college.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly. But he was, he was saying that, well, think this through. You have 25% these kids go to college, so they're away from home. They're feeling anxious, anxiety. Maybe they went to college. They didn't get a good high school education, so they're not prepared for college. So they're not doing well. they're away from home. They're unfamiliar environment.
That's the key point about college, isn't it? The key point about college, which people seldom remark upon, is the fact that it's always about getting away from home.
Yeah. What's all that about?
Yeah, you sort of take them out of the community. They're on their own. They're in a big city. Yeah. They don't know what the fuck they're doing. They're subject to all these temptations, drugs, whatever. And, they get all worked up. They develop all these various kind of psychological problems. A lot of them become JWs. And that's what's really going on there. You're sort of extracting them from their communities. It's a system of destroying economic inertia, because that is the enemy for these economic processes.
Yeah, John Rappaport's his name, by the way. John Rappaport. Then when they talk to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, they give them drugs. When they instead of just talking to them about it, how maybe you have a dating problem, you're not fitting in well, you're among strangers, you haven't made any friends yet, you're overwhelmed by the work, you're homesick. Remember homesick? They're pathologizing completely natural reactions to an insane system. You're not insane. The system's insane. But instead, they're saying, no, you're the one who's crazy. You need to take this drug. There's some sort of imbalance you're suffering. We don't know what that balance is, but it's an imbalance, so take this drug.
I think you can also apply these basic principles very loosely to the American political scene, because it seems to be that the candidate who becomes president is the candidate who is best designed to stimulate people's kind of rootless emotions.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like Trump or Hillary. Now, if Hillary was in power, I think we'd be going through a lot less of a lively presidency than we are now with Trump, because with Trump every day it's a big issue. Everything's a big issue now.
Now they're manufactured, like the Russian thing.
With Hillary, there'd be a lot of behind the scenes deals. But in terms of the media footprint, it would be much, much quieter. In fact, a lot of people are saying that because Trump's president, all these failing media companies are actually coming back to life and starting to make money again. So he sort of saved the mainstream media. And I think if Hillary was the president, things would be so boring. Even the kind of pointless neocon wars that we would probably be tepidly engaging in would be so kind of dull and uninteresting. That people would hardly notice them.
Mm-hmm.
That in a weird way that would create a lot more economic inertia than Trump, who gets everybody wound up and emotionalizes everything.
Yeah, it's people invest too much emotional there in all this election, and they get upset because Trump disappoints them and these things. Well, I'm not shocked. By he wouldn't do what he said he was going to do if you supported that to begin with. I look at his election as sort of he was allowed to win. I think his candidacy represented some sort of split within the oligarchy, that there was factions within
There was definitely a real attempt to stop him, and
I mean, there's
there were certain people who in the kind of ruling elite who did seem to be kind of like backing him at key moments and that. But I don't want to get too conspiratorial, but it's hard not to sometimes. But it definitely seems that he sort of fits into the pattern, though. He's going to be the president who's going to keep everything on the boil, so to speak. And a lot of people voted for him because they thought he would be the candidate of economic inertia. He'd get us out of a lot of pointless situations. He would sort of like calm down the global situation. Reduce the need for this massive U.S. military. That's what a lot of people were assuming when they voted for him. And then he would also kind of do something about trade, so that we don't have this sort of weird asymmetrical dysfunctional trading system that we now have. And all those things would have pushed things towards a calmer, nicer more easygoing society and global situation. But also that would also promote a lot of this economic inertia I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, it now appears that Trump's doing the opposite to all those things, and because he's doing the opposite, he's actually having a much more kind of destabilizing influence on everything, because it's unexpected, because it's the opposite of what people voted for. So they're much more, some people are a lot more angry, and a lot of people who actually were against Trump are actually kind of pleased now in a weird way. So
yeah, like McCain's praising him, Lindsey Graham's praising him, and Nancy Pelosi's praising him. It's like, oh, yeah, that's
everybody's emotionally engaged one way or the other. Nobody's like, okay, everything's settled down nice, I can go back to sleep. Nobody's doing that.
Yeah. Well, there's one. I mean, you mentioned like some of these trade issues, and we talk about what's what's expected as normal, and there's a bias towards sort of a cosmopolitanism, and we must trade in these things. And I understand the arguments of free trade. I understand the idea of comparative advantage, absolute advantage, and these things. But the problem with that is trade. Trade itself can be weaponized, and it has been throughout the centuries. Just talk about the British East India Company and the opium trade, or the slave trade for that matter, or the experience that
I tend to be mildly defensive of the opium trade usually.
Well, I mean, the point is that it was there to diverse the balance of trade, the drain of precious metals and all that, but the idea the current system right now, with her current global economic system, right, the globalism itself, it's not really a system of free trade in the sense that you have voluntary transaction and people just trading amongst each other. It's a managed trade system anyway. But the if you look at the
it's sort of evolving, because I think going back to I guess right about the time of from the Clinton presidency onwards, we had this kind of Chimerica arrangement, which is very, very pronounced and clear, and that worked out very well for people like Clinton, who could go on about how good he was at the economy and all that, but he was basically getting the he was reaping the advantages of this new kind of Chimerica system, whereby America could basically export all its debt and therefore all its inflation to countries like China and Japan, and in return get all these actual manufactured goods. And so you create this enormous consumer boom, and you get rid of all your inflation, because the Orientals and the Arabs, to some extent, store it very safely for you in these kind of like inflation-proof bunkers called bank vaults or whatever. And so, that worked out very, very well. But I think what's happened now is this kind of Chimerica period is sort of nearing its natural limits. And what's happened is it's enabled the rise of China. And so you have China's become this massive, not only this massive kind of industrial power, but they've also become this massive financial power. And they have so many financial assets as well. And they're looking for a way to kind of like, plow all those financial assets back into the global economy. Of course, by doing that, that is an implicit threat to this kind of Chimerica order and the position, the global system, and especially the position of America. And so I think what we're seeing now is a very interesting relationship between China and America developing, and that's where the focus is going to be probably in the next couple of decades. How do the Chinese deal with this position that the Chimerica arrangement put them in? How do they deal with all these vast financial resources that they now have? How do they invest that money? Do they go for a kind of their own kind of enhanced domestic society? Or do they invest the money overseas in other countries? What kind of geopolitical pool does that give them? So that's the question at the moment. And at the moment, it seems to be that the Chinese, they've developed this kind of OROB strategy. I don't know if you've heard about that. O-R-O-B, One Road, One Band strategy. And what it is basically is they invest a lot of this money in foreign countries and developing infrastructure and basically getting their foot in the door. So, like, for example, in Kenya, they've built a massive port facility in, I think, Mombasa. And that's basically, you know, a kind of loan to the Kenyans, but basically means they kind of control the Kenyans to a certain degree. It gives them a lot of leverage over those over countries like Kenya. And Kenya's just one of many African countries that they're doing this with. They're also putting a lot of money into places like, you know, the Philippines and Indonesia, basically along the sea routes to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So they're using that kind of financial power on one hand to also build up their military, but also to build up their political and diplomatic power along certain key routes. The one band refers to this, the sea lanes. And so they've got a kind of sea lane approach. And we've seen a manifestation of that with the kind of island building project that they've been involved with in the South China Sea. So they're trying to project power through that corridor. And of course, the end point would be the Middle East and the kind of the oil and gas resources there. But at the same time, they're also going for a kind of Central Asian land corridor, mm-hmm. putting a lot into these kind of Central Asian countries and so on. And the question is, how does that kind of square with American interests, or do they clash at any serious point? And what sort of conflicts will that engender?
Well, and yeah, so if you had a United Eurasian landmass economically, then that would be a big challenge to the dollar right there, because they wouldn't need to have the trade in dollars anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big challenge right there, which historically has always been the strategic imperative of the sea powers, you know, the Mackinder Doctrine, the British Empire, and you know, this is why the Britain came to blows with Germany in the 20th century.
Yes, you could cast America in the role of Britain in the 19th century and China in the role of Japan in the Germany in the 19th century, mm-hmm. and it's sort of quite a reasonably good fit.
And you do see
the Chinese, they are challenging American sea power, because the one liner part of the OROB strategy is designed to strengthen their political influence in those sea lanes towards the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Weren't they also heavily invested in Libya before Gaddafi was toppled?
I'm not really sure. I don't have precise data on that. Would they need to be? Because, I mean, I think the Libyans had enough of their own money from the oil.
Well, that's a whole other thing, whole other challenge that perhaps that Gaddafi presented.
But they're definitely very interested in Africa, and there are certain countries that they are concentrating on. They tend to be looking more at the east side of Africa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, so I mean,
Zimbabwe, Kenya, I think Ethiopia, those kind of countries, Tanzania.
Mm-hmm. But this, again, just when we're talking about, what's better for a society, for a culture? And you could look at trade itself, you know, so-called free trade, as being inherently unstable, this whole trend towards emphasis on cosmopolitan, sort of chimerical cosmopolitanism that's pushed by the free traders. It's always been, if you look at it in Great Britain, when they repealed the Corn Laws, that was used to destabilize British agriculture, and it ended up taking a heavy toll on Ireland, of course, because the free trade is what the British cited for exporting food from Ireland during the potato famine, which killed 2 million Irish, and led to the diaspora. And this sort of destabilization, I think, who was it? Was it Robert Peel or some other, the person, the head of Ireland, said that the tragedy of the potato famine, that it didn't, it wouldn't kill more than a million people. So that was the attitude.
Very Malthusian in those days.
Yeah. The problem is there was the policies itself. Now, I think Malthus died before the potato famine, I think. But really, it was what really caused the potato famine was the fact that the Irish were prevented from eating anything else but potatoes, and the fact that they had been dispossessed of their land, and they're forced into the workhouses, the poorhouses.
Simply, their great fecundity in breeding.
Yeah,
they had an enormous population in those days.
They did, but they're prevented from growing, from owning property to grow the food to support their families. And then, I think it was Robert Peel who imported Indian maize into Ireland, and they didn't stop to think as relief. They didn't stop to think that no one in Ireland knew how to prepare it properly, so people ate it and they developed these horrible gastrointestinal problems and died from that too. Just the whole big mess. But again, that's a whole other thing about that, because then that created the diaspora into North America
also to the UK. That was part of it, because the Irish were a very good source of cheap labor.
But that's a whole other distortion there, because you can't go in and dispossess the people of their land, force them into the cities, and then build factories and go, look at all this cheap labor around. Well, there's only cheap labor there because you forced them, because they were forced off their ancestral homelands. Then cite free trade. That's not, there's coercion there. And this is the model throughout China, and this is the model in Latin America. How you get cheap labor in Mexico, it's because NAFTA.
If you go back into history, everybody's a complete bastard.
That's true. So, I mean, you just sort these things out. Good examples here, in the States, we've had for a couple decades a migration north from Latin America, particularly Mexico, but even from Central America, coming up, because the demand for labor, particularly because of the housing boom and things like that. But this created an immigration, you call it immigration crisis or issue. Let's call it an immigration issue that Donald Trump capitalized on to get elected last year. But NAFTA destroyed Mexican agriculture, which created, which then forced a lot of people northward for employment. And you can't ship in subsidized taxpayer-subsidized agricultural goods into Mexico, and then that destroys local agriculture, and then they come up north, and this disrupts labor markets up here, and call that free trade, fine. Now we're getting into semantics, but it's not.
You're talking about a kind of toxic variety of free trade, which seems to be the most common type today.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, I think most people like the idea of free trade in general. But the things we're talking about, most people are set against that. So free trade that relies upon imbalances in trade, like trade in deficits, is obviously that's something that should be stopped, because there's always a price for any kind of trade in deficit. Also, free trade that leads to demographic destabilization of any kind, where you have all these population flows and cheap labor going from this broken industry to that country to compete with the native laboring class. Anything like that, that has to be the enemy. Anything that's sort of out of balance, in other words.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's got to be parameters on everything.
And also you have, within the economy, you have, distortions, because you have corporations that get all sorts of benefits. Even the idea of the corporation, limited liability, the corporation itself is sort of a legal fiction that was created that distorts the economy in many ways. But the idea, good example is the setup. You mentioned Chai America, right? This goes back to the 70s and Kissinger and the petrodollar, and what was set up after the aftermath of the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. I would argue the Bretton Woods system was set up to fail, because it was abused by the U.S. in the 60s during the guns and butter policy. This is why they had to close the gold window. And the moment it was challenged, de Gaulle faced a uh, an uprising, student uprising. Funny how that works. Yeah. But early swarming techniques. My point
is an early attempt at a color revolution.
That it seems that was the case. Yeah, it was.
They chose the wrong color, red. You know. So.
Yeah, yes, right. But you mentioned how, you know, of course, the petrodollar system itself creates a system where exports or imports are cheaper for American consumers because the dollar is overvalued abroad. It also creates a situation where our exports are more expensive, so that it creates this deindustrialization. So you have
basically import the world's unemployment.
Yeah, you yeah.
You have to find various ways to store it in American society. Yeah. Hence, you have this incredible prison system and this massive over-bloated education sector, and of course the military. A great way for storing unemployment.
Yeah, exorbitant. But when you ship the factories into China in the 80s, and all of a sudden now they're producing all the cheap goods that fill the shelves of Walmart and Target and these things. Well, you may be getting low prices every day at Walmart, but the cost of that is the destruction of local and regional businesses that may have regional or local patriotisms or loyalties, values, and
so you destroy the community basically. Yeah. You get rid of more of that nasty economic inertia that people seem so fond of.
I mean, it's inertia or a firewall or a resistance to this globalist monoculture that they want to impose. Because through the
it's completely natural and people like it, and so they tend to incline in that direction. And as they incline in that direction, as they're able to, then the kind of economic zing goes out of the global system.
But this has profound political effects because I was going through history. Is if you look at the late 1930s, early 1940s, it was Midwestern businesses that backed things like the America First Committee. Which presented a real challenge to the Eastern Seaboard elite and the Roosevelt administration.
It's actually incredible, though, that in those days America seemed to be much more politically aware, economically aware of how these things work than they are today.
Because it was less homogenized. You had regional interests. It was sectional. They knew they didn't buy into this, you know, we're all,
they knew who was screwing them, in other words. And now we have all these resources of the internet and we can get our information unfiltered and the rest of it. And people seem a lot more confused about how the whole system works. And they're more easily distracted. And, they just have to kind of like dangle a shiny object at them and they go off chasing it like a kind of naive cat.
Well, it's sensory overload because there's too much they're getting too much and you get overwhelmed by it all. I think there's a different culture, obviously people, if you live in an agrarian or manufacturing society, it's different from a society that's based on finance. You're talking. This is the reason why the Midwest is different than the city of London and New York City, and and you can see that. The problem with that is if your economic system is based on finance, and all types of and all the all the fraud and chicanery that it entails, you're not producing anything anymore. Of any value, you're not producing. You're not making cars.
You're producing the chaos, which stimulates all these various kinds of emotions, which then, in some way, feed back into the economy. Mm-hmm. So that's not strictly true, I have to say. it doesn't produce like concrete, material, useful goods that can enhance people's lives and make them feel good about doing something and then having a nap.
But when you talk about everyone has to be a consumer, Well, why? I mean, obviously we have to consume somewhat, but I'm saying, why do you have to always have to consume more? I mean, why do you have to always, why do you need a new iPhone every year?
You know, that's the, I try not to. I just, you know, that's the most revolutionary act you can do these days is just stop buying stuff. I mean, as long as you've got enough stuff, just stop buying it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, make things yourself, you know, do things by your, you know, on your own, or get friends to do them rather than pay people to do them.
Well, yeah, you break out of the money economy. There's certain security to that because if you look at the Great Depression.
Avoid debt, force, you know, that's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't get it without going into debt, then don't bother.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, during the Great Depression when the money economy collapsed, those people who weren't reliant on money and weren't in debt, they repaired their own clothes, they made their own clothes, or they grew their own food, to them it wasn't nearly as bad as those people who relied on the money economy.
Yeah, yeah. And stuff the division of labor, do everything yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, see, there's a price to that because the more you specialize, the more complicated the system becomes, the more subjected it is to collapse or failure. Then where are you? And that's what they've done today with the global economy, with these extended supply chains, and it's like
time delivery and
why wouldn't there be a you think there'd be a reason to sustain a local agriculture market, but that's not the way it is.
Kind of importing massive amounts of fragility into the system for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, everything is a lot more fragile. It would, if certain dominoes start to fall, then it could really be very, very cataclysmic.
That
resilient texture to society that we had, say, 50 or 100 years ago.
Well, I mean, look at the debt system, where the money debt system, where you need perpetual debt to keep the money supply going.
Yeah.
Where if you pay off debt.
The only thing they can do is keep digging the hole deeper. That's the only thing they can actually do to maintain the situation is to keep on digging, and they're already in a hole. Eventually that hole will either collapse in on itself and bury whoever is at the bottom of the hole, or else they'll have to find a way of reversing their track there.
Well, you need some sort of a jubilee, right? They used to have in the Bible, or was it every 7 years or something? They had a jubilee or something. You realize that the with compound interest, the system collapses.
I think you could only have that kind of jubilee with a vast upsurge in anti-Semitism. So I'm not sure if that'll be allowed for a few years yet.
Well, yeah, getting to the interest of usury and how that became accepted. That's a whole other paradigmatic shift.
What I'm referring to here is that you'd need some kind of large, very powerful emotional trigger for that jubilee to happen. That's what I'm saying. And that would be, there might be different ways of doing that, but some of the ways of doing that would be very unfortunate for.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, it's
that to say.
But I mean, you mentioned earlier talking about keep the system going, the war economy, and these things, and the U.S. could pursue another route and become a normal nation.
That's what we've got to put out there and get people behind. I think it's something that can unite the right and the left.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people on the left are fighting people on the right, and it's stupid, really.
I think that. Well, I think the most people would want that if they understood it, but the powers that be don't want that because the world will end as they know it.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. They don't know that there's an alternative way of going about things. You don't have to go out and bomb everybody, invade everyone, and try to manage the world. And these things aren't being done for your benefit anyway. They're being done under...
That's why I really think the best thing that could happen, really, in the next 30 years would be for America to get a real kick in some sort of conflict. And, if they do get sucked into Syria and it turns a bit nasty for them and, it causes all these stresses and strains at home and... It completely delegitimizes everything, then that would probably be all for the good, I think, even though it would obviously be very, very nasty for a lot of people as well.
Well, yeah, there's a reckoning. There's always the reckoning, and that's the tough part. I mean, there is, I think, we're well overdue for some normalcy, as a past president referred to it, Harding, normalcy. And, of course, that got a black eye because, the 20s are blamed, for the 30s and 40s. But, that's not necessarily the case. Not everything was inevitable there. America never really was isolationist. It was just not less interventionist. I mean, it was always engaged in foreign trade and, particularly the Eastern Seaboard elite, which was always Anglophile, was dedicated to kind of America joining up with the declining British Empire to maintain dominance of the English-speaking people, as Winston Churchill referred to it.
Yeah,
so there's always been some intrigue there, but it's just one of these things. I think what happened was, I guess, the powers that be, the financial interest, have always wanted to dominate the world, and they've done this through a series of wars and destabilization, whether that's Russia or Germany, because these were competing power blocks, and through the promotion of crisis, they've been able to control things, which is it's a standard political maneuver. Study your Machiavelli. You rule through fear,
We just have to get back to a situation where, things stay within their correct bounds. And we haven't been in that kind of situation for a very long time now.
Well, I mean, at least during the Cold War, there seemed to be some recognition of that. Because I remember I was listening to, it was late Joe Sober, and I was listening, he was giving a talk at George Mason University. And he said, well, now that the Soviet Union is gone, who's going to contain the United States? And this was 1989. So who's going to contain the United States? I think we got our answer. No one was going to. But there's the good example when you talk about some of the geopolitical wrangling versus Russia. And you have the United States, talking about Russia moving into Georgia, not Georgia, the American state, but Georgia, the former Soviet Republic, or Ukraine. This is Russia's near abroad, and NATO is continually expanding eastward and putting pressure on Russia. And then in the media here presents Putin's Russia as being provocative. I mean, come on.
It's like that meme where they show a map of Russia surrounded by U.S. military bases, and it says something like, don't put your country so close to our military bases.
Yeah. I mean, and, and anyone who just looks beneath the surface and, just a cursory analysis knows that this is just all BS. I mean, obviously, they want to keep Russia off kilter, weak, and from keeping it from forging economic ties to Europe and these things, and they're promoting these rebellions. They're even promoting Islamic fundamentalism. Let's talk about Afghanistan, right? In the 1970s, and then even in the Caucasus, and then aligning with Islamic radicals in the Balkans to take apart Yugoslavia.
there are even moves afoot to. Have another look at ISIS.
Yeah.
And, I've been reading one or two articles where they're saying, actually, maybe we should side with ISIS and get Assad out, because he's the main enemy after all,
Yeah, and Assad is just, a secular leader and supposed to, so was Saddam Hussein. I think what happens is these fundamentalist movements are proxies, because they're great agents for destabilization. You're not going to get a normal functional nation with these people waging civil war or getting into power.
But I wonder, though, because if for example, some kind of I don't think ISIS can do it because their image is simply too toxic now. But if you had a well-organized jihadist movement and they managed to get control of a few Islamic countries, I wonder how that would play out. I mean, would they might actually be a bigger problem for Israel. than somebody like Assad. I mean, one of the problems with Syria, I think, is it's naturally a very divided country.
Yes.
And so you've always had leaders in there who realize that if I'm going to hold these different groups together, we're going to need a really strong external enemy. And, luckily enough, they happen to be next to Israel. Mm-hmm. And so they could say, look at these Jews coming to the Middle East, invading our Islamic civilization, kicking the poor Palestinians out. So that provided a kind of very convenient basis for the kind of power of these Ba'athist parties in countries like Iraq and Syria.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of structural element to the animosity between Syria and Israel. And if you look around the Middle East, originally everybody was really against Israel. The Egyptians were the number one enemy. The Jordanians even were, going to war with Israel. Saudi Arabia. All these countries were very, very strongly anti-Israel. And with the help of America, of course, and with the kind of the collapse of the Soviet Union, another important factor, a lot of these countries have been able to be kind of weaned off their animosity to Israel. And the countries that were not able to be influenced in this way were mainly Syria and Iraq. And I think one of the reasons for that is because those countries actually needed this kind of anti-Israel animus to kind of bolster their own kind of their political unity. And that's now been dealt with by basically, pushing those countries into chaos and, war. And now, of course, in the case of Iraq, they've kind of they've been through that process, and they're now relatively unified, and the majority is in control. That therefore the Shiites are dominant, and they're now kind of aligning more and more with Iran. And so, you could say that on the one hand, Israel got the benefit, but in the long term, you could actually say that has made Iran much more dominant in the Middle East, and Iran is a more formidable opponent and enemy of Israel. So Israel may well have lost from that transaction. Now, if the same thing happens in Syria and some kind of like Sunni party or Sunni grouping takes over, therefore you have the kind of dominant group being represented, it would be very, very bad for the minorities, I think. A lot of them might have to actually flee to other countries. But that would create a more broad-based, unified, and in a sense, stronger Syria. And, 20, 30 years down the road, that might be more of a problem for Israel, which is in the process of oppressing a lot of Sunni Muslims in the West Bank and Gaza.
Yeah, the law of unintended consequences, yeah.
Yeah.
Just like how with the invasion of Iraq, he created a Shia Iraq, which is more now closer to Iran, which is presents a problem,
So I think from the Israeli point of view, they're actually following the wrong policy. They want to kind of like safeguard Israel for whatever kind of quaint reason they have. The most effective way of doing that probably would be to go for a kind of Balkanization effect and have lots of little statelets, a kind of Alawite state, a Druze state, whatever, even a little Syrian Christian state. Everybody gets their piece of pie, and then you break it down into lots of little countries, and they're all going to have little quibbles and quarrels about various things, and that would probably be a more effective way of ensuring security for Israel in the long term, I think. They haven't done that, obviously. Yeah. So
the most recent thing with Syria is that apparently there was a big oil find in the Golan Heights, in this area that Israel holds illegally since the 6 Day War in 67.
Yeah.
And apparently in February, I was reading the F. Womengda article about this. In February, Benjamin Netanyahu asked Trump to recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. And yeah. This is months after this huge oil find. So here we go. And this part of the Genie Corporation, which has Jacob Rothschild on its board, Dick Cheney, James yeah. Woolsey, former CIA director, and also Russian oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky. So they get this big oil find found, and now all of a sudden, of course, this the situation in Syria would appear to legitimize Israel's continued control of the Golan Heights. You say, well, since Syria fell apart, we can now have the Golan Heights and control the energy there. So that's a whole other, because there, with the whole area, the whole war there, much of the war there began when, I think, was it Assad rejected the overtures from Qatar regarding a pipeline.
Yeah.
And so
things would really have to get a lot worse, though, wouldn't they? Because there are, despite everything, there do still seem to be certain kind of, red lines, i.e., one of those red lines is that Israel's not really allowed to take over new territory.
Mm-hmm.
It can sort of like temporarily occupy certain areas. That's been allowed, with the West Bank. But even there, the understanding is that that's a temporary situation and that eventually a deal will have to be done. So I'm not sure that they would ever allow Israel to go the whole hog and annex the Golan Heights.
Well, they again, maybe a situation they can still exploit the energy there, the tap the oil yeah. there. But Israel's always been obviously its creation was problematic to say the least. But it's a country that won't even declare its own borders. That's the member of the United Nations, which is mm-hmm. How do you if you're gonna accept how the United Nations is supposed to function officially, how do you have a nation which won't even declare its own borders? It's inherently unstable, and we've seen throughout it's been constantly trying to push outward to create a greater Israel
mm-hmm.
in that area. That's created obviously created tension and instability in the area, and of course the since the 60s here in the United States, the Israeli lobby has grown so powerful that they pretty much control the Congress through bribery and blackmail. So now it's almost impossible to dislodge them.
They have an enormous influence, but they also have to try to dress it up in various ways. And there are certain very strong limitations on what Israel can do and what they can get away with. So those are very interesting. But
the question is, will they recognize what the limitations are?
It's a very interesting conundrum, Israel. The only way they can really survive would be to push for a larger Israel, to get more defensible boundaries and build up a larger country with a bigger population and more strength and depth.
And how have the Zionists historically done that?
Well, they've done it under the auspices of powerful Western countries, i.e. mm-hmm. Britain and America.
Mm-hmm. And stirring up a crisis.
Yeah, but once they're on their own, it's not so easy. And I mean, there is a lot of pushback. I mean, the Islamic world's not going away. And, you can sort of co-opt certain Arab states and bribe certain Arab politicians or whatever. And you can use a lot of American influence on this leader or that leader. But the situation is still inherently unstable, and somebody else just has to come along and push the other way for things to, kind of topple down. So, I think, they're not really going to be able to expand their borders unless you have some radically different situation from what we perceive happening in the next few decades. They're probably going to have to give in some sort of territorial demands to the Palestinians to get some kind of peace going. They have an internal Arab population aside from the population in the West Bank. And then there's all these interesting demographic shifts that are happening in Israel, whereby the kind of more religious Jews are the ones who have the larger families, whereas the more secular Jews don't. And so the nature of Israel is going to turn towards being a more theocratic state. And how's that going to play out with the 20 or 25% of the population who aren't actually Jewish? So there are a lot of kind of structural flaws that exist there, and then you've got all this enormous potential external pressure that could really solidify at any point and act in a concerted way against them. And then you've got this this very kind of extended line of support that reaches all the way through the Mediterranean across the Atlantic to America, and you have growing American ambivalence about the state of Israel. And especially as the state of Israel changes its character, that American ambivalence about Israel is going to grow, because, you know, the American support and in a wider extent international support has always been based upon this kind of mythical idea of Israel as a kind of secular state, which is, you know, how it started off as a very kind of left wing kind of Zionist, but very kind of internationalist, non-racial, non-religious state, which was kind of very implicitly Jewish. And so all these various factors in the equation are going to change a lot. And they just really, really, you know, at the end of the day, you just have to conclude they picked the worst possible part of they picked the worst possible bit of real estate in the whole world to found their kind of their ethno state. And, you know, really Madagascar or, you know, the Soviet Far East or these other options for a Israeli or a Jewish state were obviously much, much better.
It's why there? I guess maybe it's something to do with the Rothschilds and, you know, what they had, their geopolitical ambitions there. Had a lot to do, I think, in the early part of the 20th century, the growing importance of petroleum, you know.
Yeah.
And that, of course, that brings in the British Empire, which some people say was co-opted, or they sort of formed this British, you know, the British philo-Semitism is an interesting topic. Goes as far back as Oliver Cromwell. But the importance of, some say it's the growing indebtedness of the British aristocracy in the 19th century led to the Jewish takeover of British finance, the Bank of England, and that affected British. I mean, a good example is Winston Churchill, and his father Randolph was heavily in debt to Jewish creditors, and Winston Churchill was bailed out a number of times, and that coincided with his sudden shift
conversion
to being opposing Germany. So, and Winston was very practical. You know, he could be very practical. He could turn on a dime. So it's very interesting. Yeah, it's very interesting about that. What is the British relationship to Israel? And of course, we have the Balfour Declaration, much of that was promised. Balfour Declaration, not only the British promise, but the other part of the Balfour Declaration was the promise to drag America into the war. And use Jewish influence.
It shows you that the kind of Anglo Jews were just a lot more powerful than the Germano Jews.
Yes, yes.
Because I mean, actually, back in the time of World War One, Germany was a lot more of a Jude as a society than Britain or America. They had a much larger number of Jews embedded in their society.
Mm-hmm.
It's a interesting irony.
And there was a switch there, because most of the Jews identified with Germany in that war until the Balfour Declaration. There was a switch there, and that might have something to do with the Rothschilds and their designs. I mean, there's a street named after them in Israel, so and they were vital in the founding of the Jewish state. But so was the Second World War. So
yeah,
and that's a whole other can.
The best lookout for the Israeli the state of Israel would be to go for a more Balkanized Middle East and to break it all up into little ethnic and sectarian statelets that can all kind of quibble and quarrel about minor border disputes with each other.
Mm-hmm. But the problem is, why should America or any other power be involved in that enterprise?
I know. We've got to really care. This isn't going anywhere. It's not. There's nothing in it for us. And you can always buy the oil on the open market. You don't actually have to have boots on the ground.
No, that's another thing. It's not cheap if you consider the cost of occupying and bombing and garrisoning and
these things. I mean, honestly, a few years ago, everybody was talking about peak oil. I thought, oh God, we're going to run out of oil. This stuff is liquid gold. We've got to control as much of the oil producing areas of the world as possible. Send in the army. Made sense. But since then, we've had this essentially an oil glut, and they seem to be discovering oil everywhere now.
Yeah, that's peak oil is another fraud, I think. That's the whole basis for the oil depletion allowance and these things. Mm-hmm. And it's false scarcity, which is a whole other thing they like to create, because through the, the whole idea of the oil shortages in the 70s were contrived. That was there to usher in the petrodollar and also to cause the 400% increase in the price of oil, which made these oil ventures profitable overnight for the North Sea and also the Alaskan pipeline and all that. And apparently that was one of the ideas that was concocted at a Bilderberg meeting in 1972 or 73. May of 72, they called for a 400% increase in the price of oil. And the one way you do that was you foment a crisis in the Middle East. And Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, that's how Britain got into. That's probably how Britain got into the EU.
Yes, and that was also another way to arrest development in the Third World, was the oil shocks and the debt crisis, and gets us back to usury again. Well, listen, Colin, I had you a while. We talked about a whole lot of things.
It's endless, isn't it? Really.
Yeah.
These topics. One thing kind of just seegs into another.
Yeah, well, it's all related, so I figured the talk would go this way, and that's what I wanted to do, so that's great. Now, of course, people want to follow your work. You are the co-editor of Alternative Right?
That's right, yeah.
And you're
the founding site of the alt-right, actually.
And you're still the host of the alt-right podcast, right?
Yeah, we do that occasionally. But, Andy and I both do our kind of solo podcasts, and occasionally we get together sometimes with a guest and talk about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All depends on, how much, how many other things need to do in and how busy the pair of us are.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Anything else in the other projects or anything you want to point to that am I overlooking something?
Well, I just think it's kind of interesting that what started out as a kind of Middle Eastern story might have a very strong kind of Far East angle in going forward from now.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see how that works out.
Follow the Silk Road.
The blood-soaked Silk Road.
Silk Road and all that. Yeah, it's again, I think it's because like competing factions trying to control the world, and I wish people would learn to just trade and get along and have a lot of peaceful world and let people just live their lives, and we wouldn't have to put up with so much. But that would be bad for business.
And then we wouldn't have anything to talk about on the podcast.
So, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. History would be so boring without...
Without evil,
exactly. So it makes for interesting times, that's for sure.
Yep.
So, okay, well, listen, Colin, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
I'll let you go. I'll wish you a wonderful Easter weekend, Easter Sunday.
Thank you.
So, and I'll let you go. And when I'll probably post this probably on Sunday. And when I do, I'll send you the link.
Great.
Listen, thanks a lot. Thanks. Great talk.